that. That's started. And we are going. You are listening to Irish Radio Canada Home and Abroad, and I am delighted to be connecting with David McWilliams. And David is an economist, author, podcaster, journalist, documentarian, and broadcaster, and he's the founder of the world's only economics and stand-up comedy festival, which I find intriguing, Kilkenomics, and described by the Financial Times as simply the best economics conference in the world. And he's also the co-founder of the Dawkey Book Festival, Ireland's largest literary ideas. And David has just published a book called Money, A Story of Humanity. And David has previously written 5 books, and he writes a weekly column with the Irish Times, which we keep an eye on. And his latest book is Money, A Story of Humanity, charts the relationship between humans and money from a tally stick in ancient Africa to coins in the Republican Greece, and from mathematics in the medieval Arab world to the French Revolution, and from the emergence of the US dollar right up to today's cryptocurrency and beyond. David, thanks a million for coming along, taking some time.
No problem, Austin. How are you? All is good in Canada?
All is well. You can tell me probably better than I can tell you. So you would have a finger on the financial pulse in a way that I would not. But
do you know that I started my career, my very first job ever was as a dishwasher in Ontario Place in Toronto.
Right.
Many, many years ago. I lived in Bloor and Huron, just there beside the University of T. So I have very, very fond memories of Spadina and all that part of the world from my dishwashing days when I was a young fellow, when I was a student.
Well,
my fond memories of Canada.
My first job was a kitchen porter in Dublin.
Right, well, there you go. I was basically a kitchen porter in Toronto.
The common
denominator is the kitchen porter. Kitchen porter.
And then I actually did kitchen porter at one stage in the Bank of Ireland, and then I worked in the Bank of Ireland.
Oh wow! So, okay, well, I'm glad to see that there's social mobility in the Bank of Ireland.
There's progressively upward, and that's actually part of what this comes to down to is that you talk about starting your career using your hands, and I the same, but money. And a history of humanity. And what I found fascinating with this is that you trace it right back beautifully from where I can get it, that it took money for people to actually start doing things that they couldn't do without them.
Yeah, I mean, the central thesis of the book is that money is the most wonderful technology that humans have come up with in the last 5,000 years, and that you can't understand the history of modern humanity, and by that I mean humans since, let's say, the Sumerian civilization, where we begin to organize ourselves in urban areas and urban civilizations. You can't really understand nor explain that story until you understand the story of money and the central role that money has in human progress, human innovation, human animation. Essentially, it's the story of what I call a very clever ape and a very wonderful social technology. So that's, I suppose, even as an economist, that's an unusual way of looking at money. But having alighted on that sort of explanation in my head, then a lot of things make a lot of sense. And a lot of things that used to be looked very complicated make a lot of sense.
Now, one of the things I also found fascinating was you, as an economist, you very early on say an awful lot of your peers really don't understand money.
I think that's very true, actually. Many, many economists spend all their time in academia, and as a result of that, they really don't engage with the world of money, finance, choices, ups and downs, going from kitchen porters to working in banks, all that sort of stuff, you know. That's the one thing. But the second thing, I think, is that economics shies away from what actually makes money fascinating, which it's kind of transgressive, it's dangerous, it's sexy, it explains all sorts of things. People want it. People do a lot of things to get it. People, when they get it, they don't want to lose it. It causes us enormous amounts of energy we expend to actually not just get money, but to actually create things around money. It puts a price on desire, on many humans' emotions, all those sort of things. So that's the sort of fascinating part of money that I see. I was attracted to. Whereas, you know, I compare economists to like slightly upmarket plumbers in the sense that plumbers can tell you for example, how water is pumped around a house, how much water the house needs, how many pumps it needs, how the pipes all conjoin, etc. But the plumber usually can't tell you why we need water for life.
Right.
And the ecologist likely also can tell you, you know, if there's too much money, is it too little, inflation, central banking, or, and I speak again as a former central banker, but they really don't explain what actually money does to us. That's, I suppose, what gives the money, the book, a different slant to other books written about money.
Well, the other thing on that concept is, well, as you say, money really is a concept. Because, you know, when you talk about a plumber can tell you how much water you need, and water is tangible. But you actually effectively say, while paper is tangible or a coin is tangible, that money in itself is a concept.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting we can speak about water. So the book originally could have been called The Fifth Element. And by that I mean that the ancient Greeks and ancient societies and civilizations believed that humanity and all life came from four fundamental elements that exist in nature. So it's water, wind, land or earth, and sun or heat. But I think that humans created a fifth element, which is money. And this element has propelled humans in a sort of a Promethean fashion, in the same way as, for example, Zeus was very upset with Prometheus for giving fire, that's the element of heat, to humans back in the old days, because he understood with mastery of fire, humans could actually overwhelm the gods. And that's the elemental force that we know when we talk about Prometheus. I think the Promethean force of the ancient world could well have been fire, but the Promethean force of the modern world is money. And you can't really explain the modern world without explaining money. Those sort of ideas germinated around in my head for quite some time. And then, Austin, what I decided to do was go back to the very beginning to see where money really started. There is evidence, although it's not conclusive, that of a fascinating story of a baboon's femur that was found in the 1950s in Congo, but is dated to about 19,000 to 20,000 years ago. And it's an amazing thing. I went to see it in the Belgium Museum of Sciences there last summer. And it's got all these little tiny little notches in it. And one of the theories is those notches represent who owes what to whom. So it's a very old school, like a Stone Age tally stick, if you will, or to use the modern parlance, a Stone Age blockchain. But and then it's sort of, we don't get much more evidence of money, but then until about 5,000 years ago, and then it becomes overwhelming. And that evidence suggests that money coincided with that period when we stopped being nomadic, and we became domesticated and our urban dwelling, our very, very small-scale urban dwelling. And then that raised the question in my head was, why is that? Why did that happen, where it did, and when it did? And my conclusion, after having thought about it quite a bit, is that basically money is a tool that humans came up with to deal with complexities of relationships that emerged when we began to hang out with and interact with groups that were larger than our family. So rather than, let's say, 100 people, we're talking thousands of people you have to interact with. So you need a technology to, I call it almost like a coping mechanism. And what you also see is that not only does money emerge around 5,000 years ago in this civilization called Sumeria, which is in now the lower part of Iraq. It's, you know, one of the great civilizations. These are the fellows who invented the wheels, so they're not, these are no slouches, these lot. But what you also see is that other inventions that we would regard as cornerstones of civilization also emerge around the same time, which is writing, which is numeracy, which is counting, which is basic mathematics, which is legal systems, and one very interesting is organized religions, like structured religions with priests and all that stuff. So if you think that these are tools that humans need to get on with each other, then money begins to look like a foundational technology for organizing human societies. And then if you leap from that to now and you say, well, what has been really fascinating is that over those 4,000 or 5,000 years, there's been many ways of organizing human societies, you know, feudal societies, or religious-based societies, even communist nirvanas. But they've all gone by the wayside. And what has remained with us is society organized around this thing, money, which is even more fascinating because it's entirely a figment of the human imagination. It doesn't exist in the natural world. It is an entirely human notion, and it resides in our heads. And that, again, is something that, when you begin to think about it, is really quite exceptional, that the underlying technology that gels the modern society of 7, maybe soon to be 8 billion people, and makes the whole thing work, and makes the whole world go round, is actually made up. That's the fascinating thing.
When you talk in terms of where things changed, 5,000 BC or thereabouts or beforehand.
Well, no, about 3,000 BC, about 5,000 years ago.
Okay, about 2,000 BC. And then when the concept switched from what would be arithmetic to algebra.
Yeah, and I
found that fascinating, because up until that point in time, that there was the religious connotation as well as the mathematical connotation.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's when you go from, again, a massive intellectual leap from basic counting, addition, to algebra. Any child who's gone to secondary school will know that it was quite a big leap even back then. And the idea is, again, algebra is another technology. What I like to look at these sort of things is, if you regard technology as a thing that enables something else to happen, right? Algebra is a technology, almost like learning a new language, if you will. And I suppose my degree is in maths, so I'm kind of into all that carry on, or I used to be years ago, but it gets rusty after a while, believe me. And when I'm teaching in Trinity, you know, I have to go back to basic principles before we start. But I think every teacher will actually accept that you have to go back and SWAT again. But what is interesting about algebra is algebra can't exist without the concept of zero, mm-hmm. and going from positive to negative numbers. And then you think, well, when did zero come in, and why did it come into Europe so late, into the Christian world so late? And algebra is something that we robbed, really, from the Arabs. And the Arabs robbed it from the Persians, and the Persians robbed it from the Indians. And I dare say the Indians probably robbed it from the Chinese if I went deep enough, because what you notice when you do these big history books is the Chinese invented everything. Okay? We're only in the halfway place. But anyway, the story of how zero jumped into Europe via the island of Sicily is in the book, around a young man who later became known as Fibonacci, who was a mathematician, but he was originally known as Leonardo da Pisa. And what I say in the book is that without Leonardo da Pisa, there's probably no Leonardo da Vinci. And what I mean by that is, Leonardo da Pisa, by creating an entire new encyclopedia for mathematics, gave merchants a language that they could speak to each other with, called the balance sheet. And by using the balance sheet, merchants all over Europe who didn't speak each other's language could speak the language of commerce. That's number one. And number two, it short-circuited all sorts of multiplications and divisions. And it's also, by using zero, allowed merchants to deal in very big numbers and count very big numbers. So suddenly trade had a soft technology and language through which it could expand dramatically. And it could be understood by, you know, English-speaking traders, Italian-speaking traders, all that sort of stuff, Greeks, Germans, Spaniards, French, and I presume Irish traders when we began to emerge out of the sort of Viking Age. So those stories, I think, are endlessly fascinating, because what they do is they allow us to tell a story of humanity through the prism of money that kind of links everything together. That's what I think. That's the interesting thing.
And on that, when going back to where we were discussing how it's a concept and people having an appreciation of it as a concept, what I also found fascinating, how you describe how Hitler had a very thorough understanding,
yes,
of how he could effectively destroy an economy by flooding it with useless money.
Well, I think that what we do know about Hitler is he had a very effective understanding of human psychology. And he understood, and unfortunately was extremely efficient at creating circumstances whereby many millions of people ended up believing in apocalyptic ideas of race and superiority. And he understood how to get in. So he understood crowd dynamics extremely well. And money is a crowd phenomenon, right? Because it brings crowds together in a singular purpose. And Hitler also experienced what happens when money dies during the Weimar Republic. So he saw that when you mess with money, you don't just mess with prices and inflation things. You mess with people's heads, people's sense of stability and foundation. And after the Battle of Britain in 1940-1941, Hitler realized that he can't beat these British with bombs. These are a plucky bunch. They defend their country extremely well. But in the same vein as Napoleon, Hitler believed that, as Napoleon dismissed the English as a nation of shopkeepers. So he thought, well, why don't we destroy them with money? And he orchestrated the world's largest forgery of English 5 and 20 pound notes, which was executed in a concentration camp called Sachsenhausen by Jewish printers, fine artists, metal workers, bankers, mathematicians, everyone you need to forge a currency, because you need all sorts of characters and all sorts of skills. And they effectively pulled the wool over the Bank of England, which is an amazing story, in 1942. They were ready to go by 1943. The plan was hatched in 1941. The idea was that these pound notes would be dropped over England by the Luftwaffe. And by the end of 1943, fortunately for the world, I think, but unfortunately for Hitler, the war situation had changed. The Luftwaffe were losing in Russia. They couldn't spare the planes. So the Germans, the Nazis, had to figure out what to do with 107 million forged pound worth of pound notes. And they found a very, very good market for it. So a bit like the crypto finds a dark market these days. They did a whole black market in art. They had a whole black market in armaments. They even paid for their own visas to get out to Argentina with this sort of money. And I think in a very bizarre turn of fate, they paid the bribe to hand over Mussolini, who was kidnapped by Italians, and the Germans got him again. But the Germans bribed their way to finding Mussolini, and the money was that forged sterling. So, I mean, who would have known, or who knows what might have happened had in 1943, the Germans dropped that money over to the UK.
As a former low-level retail banker, I had an appreciation for what was the liquidity ratio, and also this concept of that money was backed by gold.
Yeah.
But you cover how the gold standard was there, went and came back. As we move up, I recall, you know, the liquidity ratio was something that you relied on in a way to protect the depositors' assets. But these kind of things, as pressure was put on to grow economies, they were diluted.
Yeah, they were completely diluted. Well, I make the point that, a bit like yourself, I trained as a central banker. And I believed the story that I was told in university and in central banking, that in a way the central bank decides how much money the economy should have and then pushes the money to the commercial banks. They then push that money out to the retail banks, and the retail banks push that money out onto the street. But that's actually not how it works at all. And that's one of the big reveals in the book, is that what you think about money is wrong. Not wrong, it's just a less than satisfactory explanation. So what actually happens is commercial banks create money out of nothing under a license given by the central bank. And the central bank, in effect, trusts them to deal with that part of money I call finance. So there's a difference between finance and currency. So currency is the stuff that Canadian dollars in your back pocket. But finance is the stuff that finances the property boom in Toronto, right? And that is a completely different creature. That's a creature of commerce. It's backed by trust, it's backed by legislation, it's backed by a whole lot of evolutionary social traits that humans have put together. And it's very, very independent of the central bank. So even today, you know, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by half a percentage point as if they control the economy. They don't. I mean, we know in economics that a monopolist, who is the printer of money, can control either the price or the quantity, but not the two of them together. So we are in a bizarre situation that what actually keeps the system together is this, again, ephemeral notion of trust, which is a very, very, very nebulous but unbelievably strong idea. And it's to do with the fact that because money is a social network, in effect, it is a horizontal network. And horizontal networks are gelled together by what they call the strength of weak ties. Okay, and the weak ties are very, very, very strong, and they like to expand. And the weak tie at the center of money is that understanding, that faith we have, that it will not be undermined or besmirched or degraded. And that's the only thing that keeps the system together. But it's a very strong thing, you know?
Right. But when you say it keeps the system together, you describe also that the system is cyclical.
Yeah, because humans are cyclical.
And, right, and in keeping it together, you back in were one of the ones that came with the coining the term Celtic Tiger, as I understand it. But you were also one of the ones that were kind of waving a flag and saying, "There's a storm on the horizon over here."
But I'd like to think that the reason I was raising the flag, and there are very few economists doing it, in fairness, if we're very honest, was because I spent a lot of time thinking about money and finance and human psychology and the nature of being a human and our giddiness and the way we influence each other and the way we're fragile and the way we like to cod ourselves, as my father would have said, you know, that you're only codding yourself. And as a result of that, I've always been very skeptical about the ability of what I would call narrow gauge economics to explain the human condition. Maybe in a different world, I would have studied more Freud than Keynes, but who knows, you know? But I ended up studying Keynes and Friedman, and I kind of used that to try and explain what I think is this elemental technology, which I'm increasingly fascinated by. And I'm glad to say, Austin, so too are people in Ireland, because the book went directly to number one in Ireland this week. It's only had a couple of days. So people are fascinated by it. You know, they want to know, like, wow, what's going on? Tonight we're playing, we've been doing theatres all around Ireland. We did a couple in London there last week. And there is a great appetite. And maybe one of these times I'll come over to Canada and do it. There's a great appetite for this sort of stuff.
On that as well, you know, when you did raise the flag, you raising the flag wasn't really appreciated, because, again, people who are perceived themselves to be in power. And I say that...
I suppose, you know, you don't want to be raining on a fella's parade. And I didn't really want to do that. I felt that Irish people were being sold a pup. And I felt, it turned out to be an accurate hunch, that this would lead to enormous social, political, and personal anxiety. And I felt that the people who were in charge really didn't understand what they were doing. It also probably was a reflection of my own career choices. I'd gone from being very deep on the inside. You know, you can't get more insider than an economist in the central bank, whose career normally you stay there and you work your way up. And by the time I was warning, I was a self-employed economist, which is, again, a very unusual, a rather unique person. So maybe my career has always been around trying to figure out this money idea, what it does to us, but also to maybe use that to help others at least understand the world, or understand the world of finance and economics. So, but you are right. It didn't make you very popular.
Okay. I know. Time is scarce. There's two things I do want to cover. One is you described that there's a parallel world of money out there that is used, that governments really don't wish to acknowledge it exists, but it exists. And I must say, I found that fascinating. That
the euro dollar market, for example, is entirely unregulated, entirely. Wild West, cowboyish market. The amazing thing is it constitutes an extraordinary 12 billion US dollars. And that's 12 trillion US dollars that the Federal Reserve just does not control. It's all offshore. So it's Cayman Islands, it's Ireland, it's Britain, it's all these banks that lend together and against these assets in dollars that actually create the dollars themselves. It's a phenomenally terrifying, if you will, notion that there exists a parallel massive economy. 12 trillion, you're talking about the economy of Britain, France, and Germany probably together.
Right.
Okay? Like, think about it. And it is of dollars that are simply printed and created by investment banks, have been since the Second World War, and are out there, and the Fed has no control over them.
The other thing that, you mentioned it earlier on, that, you know, if somebody can control money, they're it. So cryptocurrency is where we are now. And again, I haven't really got my head around cryptocurrency, and anything that I hear about it, I kind of run a mile. But to me, given that money is an idea, I can buy into cryptocurrency is no more than a digital idea.
Yeah, it's a digital idea that will eventually be replaced by central bank issued digital currency. So I think my major dilemma with cryptocurrency is that we just talked there about money that is not created by the state, and we're worried about that. Cryptocurrency is created by private individuals. So for me, it seems, and it's currency created by private individuals. So I don't think the states, i.e. countries around the world, will ever give permission for this to become a significant threat to the monetary system, simply because money is too powerful a tool for the state to give away.
To wrap up, as I say, I am very conscious of time. Tell me briefly, very briefly, about Kilkenomics.
Oh, Kilkenomics is a bizarre idea, which is, I came up with about 10 years ago, maybe more, about 15 years ago, which is economic and stand-up comedy. I'm very friendly with a lot of comedians, and we just had a conversation after I'd done a one-man show in the Abbey many years ago, and one of the comedians was saying, look, you know, there's something, the way about you explain in economics, that maybe if we make it humorous, people will understand it a wee bit more. And I thought about it a lot, and I said, okay, let's do it. And we did it, and it started in Kilkenny small, and it's now grown to the largest economics conference in the world. It's the largest festival. We do about 11,000 tickets over the weekend on the 8th of November. We would love to see some Irish Canadians come over. One of these days we'll get the Big Mac Daddy of Irish Canadian economists, the former head of the Canadian Central Bank, whose name bloody well escapes me now. What's his name?
Is that down about Mark Carney?
Carney. Mark Carney is the, you know, he's the Big Mac Daddy of Irish Canadian economists. So one of these days we'll get him on. If you know him, give him a shout.
Indeed. David McGuinness. Right. I know you're tight for time. So the book is Money, A Story of Humanity, and it is available in bookstores. It is just launched here in Canada as well. I've no doubt you will be on the circuit over here at some stage.
I love it.
And Simon & Schuster, the publishers. So if you do a search, Money, A Story of Humanity, you'll find it. And David's own site is davidmcwilliams.ie.
Great stuff, Austin. Listen, take care of yourself. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you, David.